depending on where you are in the world. And welcome to Black Hat Radio, presented by Dark Reading. I'm your host for this episode, Kurt Franklin, and we are thrilled to have you here. Whether you are in Las Vegas at Black Hat, taking advantage of some of the first day sessions and exhibitions, or whether you are still at your desk looking for the news coming out of one of the largest, most prominent security conferences on the face of the earth, we're glad to have you with us. Now, I say that this is brought to you by Dark Reading, and that's absolutely true. The editors of Dark Reading at this moment are all in Las Vegas covering Black Hat, taking part in some of those sessions, doing the things that only the editors of Dark Reading can do. But before they headed to the desert, they were talking to some of the people presenting at Black Hat. We recorded those conversations and are bringing them to you today and tomorrow at this same time. Well, let's get started with our first interview. In this first session, Dark Reading community editor Marilyn Cahotas got together on the phone with Joshua Sachs, who is the director of the Invincia Labs Data Science Research Group. He's presenting multiple sessions at Black Hat, but Marilyn spoke with him about why security data science matters and how its different pitfalls and promises, why security data science matters and how it's different. The pitfalls and promises of data science-based breach detection and threat intelligence. There we go. Marilyn did a much better job of that than I did. And she had a great conversation with Josh. So let's kick back and listen to this conversation, Marilyn Cahotas and Josh Sachs.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Cahotas, Dark Reading's community editor, and with me in the studio today is John Sachs from Invincia Labs. He's talking about why security data science matters and how it's different from traditional cybersecurity. Hi, Josh. How are you doing?
Good. How about you?
Good. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest today. Joshua directs Invincia Labs Data Science Research Group, whose function is researching and developing breakthrough security data science technologies. Highlights of his work at Invincia have included leading the development of a system that automatically discovers and visualizes malware genealogical relationships, and also leading the development of novel data science approaches for detecting, analyzing, and visualizing both malware and malicious network behavior. Prior to Invincia, Josh served as a lead research engineer at Applied Minds, which is an interdisciplinary technology think tank where he led a two-year research project focused on applying machine learning and data visualization to the problems of modeling enterprises' cybersecurity vulnerabilities. So we're talking about Josh's Black Hat presentation. I figured one of the first questions our audience want to know is, why does data science matter to security professionals, and what do they need to know to take advantage of it?
Yeah. So I think data science matters a lot to security. I think it probably always has, but I think sort of in the last few years, it's become even more urgent that we start applying data science more rigorously to security, mostly because in a lot of ways, at least many security problems are really search problems, right? You have terabytes of data being generated by our enterprise networks every week, and there's a needle in a haystack there, right? So within those terabytes of data, the vast majority of the data are benign, right? They're generated as the result of normal users going about their daily benign activities, but there on any large network, right? There's typically some malicious behavior going on, there's just too much data to sift through, you know, so we need, you know, for humans to just sort of manually sift through the data and identify attacks. So there needs to be some sort of automation that goes into identifying attacks. And I think that's where data science and big data and analytics come into the picture.
Big data is a large and evolving discipline. But are you saying that security researchers need to be data scientists, or is there a kind of a middle ground? What do they need to know in this area and not need to know?
Yeah. So I think that it's important that more security researchers acquire data science as sort of part of their set of tools. I think security practitioners don't necessarily need to be data scientists, but they need good tools that are sort of founded in data science to help them help them do their jobs and find attacks.
What are the, you've mentioned some tools that they need to learn that they probably don't have in their toolbox right now. Could you describe what those would be?
Yeah. So I don't think, so in my opinion, I don't think there are a lot of good big data and analysis tools out there for security practitioners yet. I think that it's really on security researchers to come up with those tools. I think there's the beginning of, you know, there are tools like Splunk and, you know, security, you know, integrated event management solutions that help collect lots of data, right, and do some analytics on that data. But I think there's a big gap between what the existing tools provide and what we really need, which are tools that really help us get to the point where we can detect targeted attacks against networks. And I think just the fact that you're seeing so many, you know, I mean, I think there's a sort of common knowledge nowadays, right, that enterprise security is not very good, right? And that dedicated attackers are able to get into most networks and go undetected for long periods of time. And I think part of the reason for that is because we don't have the tools that we need. So I think right now, I mean, what I'm going to emphasize in my talk is that the security research community really needs to. I think it would be worth the investment for more security researchers to get into developing the kinds of tools that could really help practitioners close the gap between what they have and what they need.
Is there something that security researchers can be doing right now to either find the tools or develop them or get the skills that they need to use big data in their research?
Yeah. So I mean, in my talk at Black Hat, I'm going to be going through a few case studies where the researchers in my group developed tools that I think are really, really useful in helping both detect attacks and analyze attacks after they've happened and figure out who's attacked a network and how we can follow up and clean up a network and that kind of thing. We in my group, we use there are a set of libraries that we use that we have been really helpful in sort of kickstarting our research. So we use a library called sklearn, which a lot of data scientists use to do machine learning. We use D3, which is a very popular visualization library. Then we use just the kind of, you know, standard database technologies like Mongo or MySQL, Redis, those kinds of databases. So we pretty much use the standard suite of data science technologies that the data scientists use to do our research. I think the difference is that we're applying those technologies to security, whereas most of the data science community is focused on other kinds of problems.
I know it's hard to paint a picture in a radio broadcast, but could you talk through some of the real world examples that you've used in your application of data science to some of the problems in security researchers are dealing with, like attack detection or threat intelligence or malware mm-hmm. analysis? Can you walk through a couple of those with us?
Yeah. So I'll talk about some of the things I'm going to talk about in the Black Hat talk. So one set of projects that we've been working on over the last couple of years revolves around malware detection. So instead of using sort of signature-based systems like antivirus engines to detect malware, we're building machine learning approaches to detecting malware. And what we're finding is that those approaches can be really helpful complements to antivirus systems. So we're detecting attacks that antivirus engines are missing using these machine learning approaches. And what we're finding, so more specifically, what we're finding is that applying deep neural network technologies to the malware detection problem is giving us the best results that we've seen, both that we've achieved in our lab, and also the best results that we've seen in the published academic literature or in what security companies are advertising. So that's exciting for us, and I'm going to talk more about that in the talk. And
can you describe a little bit what those results are, what you've seen?
Yeah. So we're finding that one thing is we're finding that we can detect stuff that's missed by the antivirus engines, and we're finding that we can detect it at a reasonably low false positive rate. So for example, if we have a dial on our system that trades off between false positives and true positives. So what that means is that if you dial in one direction, you'll detect more attacks, but you'll get more false positives. And if you dial another direction, you'll get fewer false positives, but you're going to miss more attacks. And so what we find is we set the dial to giving us, say, one false positive a week or so on a typically sized customer network, let's say 10,000 users, this kind of thing. We can detect something like 80% of the malware, and a lot of that malware is missed by many of the antivirus engines.
And the benefit of that is because you reduce the noise to signal to noise ratio, or
I guess the benefit of that is that many of these the malware that we're detecting would have gone undetected had we not used this. I mean, we can, you know, would have gone undetected had we used even the top antivirus engines, right? So what we're finding is that using these, using this big data approach as opposed to a sort of traditional signature based approach allows us to detect attacks that we would have missed.
Interesting. And how hard would it be for the average enterprise security team to do something like that? You said earlier that the mm-hmm. tools aren't readily available. You obviously have the expertise to develop that. Security executives sort of as the first steps towards developing a data analytics team in their organization.
So that's true, right? So the technology we developed, the people working on this project are PhD and computer scientists. It's not the typical kind of staff that you'd have in a security team in an enterprise. So what people in security operations centers can do to incorporate big data analytics into their workflow. So people are using data analytics to try to detect malicious behavior right now. I think when I've been to SOX and seen the kinds of analytics people are doing, I've been skeptical that the analytics people are using are actually going to surface targeted attacks. Just because I think a lot of times people deploy analytics based on their own intuition about what might help them detect attacks, but not based on actual testing and assessment of those analytics. So for example, like maybe an organization deploys an anomaly detection system that's based on the intuition that if people have three failed login attempts at their workstation, right, per day, then that's worth looking at because maybe somebody's trying to hack into their machine, right? I think that sounds intuitive, right? That might sound intuitive to people, like that's going to help catch an attack, but it's actually an empirical or sort of scientific question whether or not that's actually useful, right? And so what we found in our group is that it's important to spend just as much or even more time testing a hypothesis than developing the software. We might think that three login rule is a good rule, and we might spend some time programming a system that detects if somebody has tried to log in three times and failed, right? But the time that we invested in actually implementing that analytic, we should spend as much or more time testing whether or not we should have any confidence that that actually leads us to detect an attack, right? So I guess what I'd recommend to security teams is that they, if they think an analytic might be useful, they spend just as much time testing that analytic as they spend evaluating it. So they know when that analytic raises an alarm, how much confidence they should have that they should actually follow up on it, or how much confidence they should have that it's actually useful.
Is this a role, what you're describing, is this some discipline, I guess, that most security researchers have, or is it a skill that they need to develop, or do you need to get more different people on the team, like specifically, the data scientist that has that specific background?
So I think on a team of like 10 security analysts, I think it makes sense to have to have a data scientist, you know, because they can bring that, like, the sort of quantitative skill, like even sort of basic quantitative skills, to the table that I think are really important. Like, so for example, like in the case of the you know, example three login idea, right? I think a data scientist would approach that hypothesis in a very different way than most security analysts, who would sort of go with their gut feeling. So I think having a data scientist on the team would allow the team to sort of pose, like, put forward hypotheses about what might help them detect attacks, and then actually evaluate them, right? Because there's some simple statistics that the data scientist could do to evaluate how effective a given analytic might be.
What are some of the areas that you think, you know, that work best for this kind of approach to security research? I mean, are there certain problems that are, you know, more solvable by this method? You see this as the wave of the future? Is all security research going to be using data science 5 years from now, 10 years from now? What do you see as the real world application in the short term, midterm, and long term?
Yeah, so I think there are some areas of security research that probably don't need data science, like, or at least don't need data science as a central focus. So for example, vulnerability research, like people who are figuring out where a web browser has vulnerabilities and this kind of thing, right? I mean, that's a very different kind of work than data science. Although I do think that data science could probably help in those areas, like help identify risky parts of a program that are worthy of vulnerability researchers' attention and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I think probably vulnerability research is going to have a separate set of skills that need to be the central focus around program analysis and knowing where programmers mess up and create vulnerabilities, that I think is really separate from data science. In the area of malicious behavior detection and attack detection, and knowing that somebody's attacking you or has broken into your network, I think data science is going to become really central to that field. I think we're beginning to see a move away from signatures as the central focus to doing detection. I think signatures are always going to be somewhat important in doing that kind of detection, but I think that you know, signatures clearly don't solve the problem in doing detection. And I think the most promising, new development in doing detection in the security context is machine learning, data science, and data visualization, and those kinds of things.
Can you describe what that would look like?
So I think so it's sort of like along the lines of what I've been saying. I think that there's going to need to be, and probably will be, a move towards security operations centers using data science tools to do detection that they trust and that have been validated and that we actually know are effective in detecting attacks. I think there's going to have to be more of an acceptance of tools that give some level of false positive, I think there's going to be more of an acceptance of high false positive rates, right? Because I think it's hard to do targeted attack detection without a significant number of false positives. But I think to make up for the fact that we're going to have to deal with more false positives to do security effectively, we're going to need really good visualization tools that allow security analysts to quickly cut through the noise and make a decision about which of you know, a few hundred alarms every day, right, are actually worth looking into.
Right.
There's already a move towards using a combination of sort of statistics, machine learning, and data visualization tools to help detect the hard attacks to detect. I think it's going to be much more of a movement in that direction in the next few years, and I think there needs to be.
It's exciting. We're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you one last question. What advice would you give to the security researcher that really wants to embellish their skills in data science to further their career going forward? What should they be doing now?
Yeah, so I think it's getting easier and easier to pick up data science as a skill set. There are a lot of useful, like if you know how to program in Python, there are a lot of, or Java or any of the major languages, there are a lot of really useful toolkits that you can pick up that allow you to experiment with data mining methods. And I think so. Starting to look at those tools, which you can find through a simple Google search, and also picking up like a undergrad data mining textbook can be really helpful for just giving you a sense of like the lay of the land. I think that applying data science to security is new enough that there's a lot of exciting stuff you can do. With not that you don't have to be an expert in data science to start applying data science usefully to security.
Right. Well, thank you very much for sharing your wisdom on data science and security and your presentation from Black Hat. I think we're going to have to sign off now. This is Marilyn Cahotas, signing off for Dark Reading Radio at Black Hat. Thanks for coming to our broadcast.
Thanks a lot.
Well, our thanks to both Marilyn and Josh Sachs for that great conversation. I hope you have a chance, if you are in Las Vegas, to stop by and see one of Josh's presentations there at Black Hat. Now, we're going to turn to a conversation that Dark Reading senior editor Sarah Peters had with Dean Zisman, the CTO of Symmetria. Dean is presenting Breaking Honeypots for Fun and Profit at Black Hat, and they talked a bit about that. Now, the interview, Sarah Peters talking with Dean Zisman.
I'm Sarah Peters, senior editor at Dark Reading, here with Dean Zisman, CTO of Symmetria, who will be presenting at Black Hat the session Breaking Honeypots for Fun and Profit, with Gadi Evron and Itamar Sher, also from Symmetria. Dean, thanks for being with us today.
Sure, thank you.
So you say in your session abstract that the way most honeypots are implemented is weak, making them easy to detect. So what would you say is so wrong then with the usual implementation?
Well, to start off, honeypots have been around for a number of years, I think over a decade, and they're a very, very powerful concept. The concept of if somebody is interacting with a machine that they're not supposed to be interacting with, then you can validate that they're a threat is a very, very powerful concept. And honeypots, all the open source projects and some of the not open source projects have tried to implement that. And what we feel is there's a sort of a gap in how honeypots are perceived in terms of what they actually give you in terms of how they're implemented. And to explain that is just that they're very good tools when you want to be blocking automatic attacks or botnets or stuff like that. But somehow the industry has thought about honeypots as something that also is able to capture very advanced attackers, APTs, or advanced penetration groups. And what our talk is about is showing how an advanced attacker is very, very capable of being able to detect most of these projects and be able to subvert them and even in some cases use them to his advantage.
Okay. Well, then in that case, once you're able to detect it, how do you turn it to your advantage?
Well, first of all, methodology, as soon as you realize that the defender is trying to deceive you and you know that before you've given any information to the defender, you've got a way of deceiving him back by using ways of misdirection or any other logic play I can think of to make him not pay attention to what you want him to be paying attention to. And in the technological terms, some of the projects we've looked at had problems where you can be using their methods of blocking out certain IPs or other data for your own usage when you want to be blocking out the defensive mechanisms in a network. So you're able to use the honeypot's way of shutting down or blacklisting stuff for your own advantage.
You know, I've often wondered if honeypots were, I wondered if they would be as effective as they sounded like they would be, because the concept works for catching insects. Right? Like, you've got something that's sweet and tempting, but for the most part, I think that cyber criminals are slightly more intelligent usually than insects, that they would see something that's just too good to be true, and it would immediately raise their hackles, and they would leave. So, what is it then that you're looking for that says clearly this has got to be a trap?
Yeah,
what makes it so easy to detect?
That's a very good question. So, if for example you're an attacker and you're interested in exploiting a machine you're seeing on the network, and you're using your very, very cool zero-day exploit nobody's ever even heard of, and then your exploit just fails, and it doesn't make any sense, right? Because that's the certain fingerprint of a machine you're supposed to be able to attack, and it's got all the right versions and whatever, and you immediately realize that something is wrong. And then when you try and interact with that machine, you see that it's not an actual full-blown machine, or it behaves in a very weird way. And that's how attackers have always seen honeypots coming in their path, because it doesn't live symbiotically with the regular attack flow. It's just if an attacker is going through a network, he's going to notice the honeypots anyways, even if he's not looking for them. So what we're showing is how, with very, very easy methods, you can detect the honeypot with very high guarantee and certainty. And you know, it's sort of like giving a honey allergy to that insect, right? He's aware of what's trying to trap him, and he's using that to his advantage.
Okay, and then once you know that this is a honeypot, how are you kind of, what's the next step then? How do you use it against the defender? I mean, obviously, I guess then you could bypass it somehow, but is there some way to, I don't know, improve your attacks or better be stealthier somehow in that way? Or does it, you know, does it help you actually being able to find that honeypot as opposed to impede you?
Yeah, so in the most trivial sense, you're just able to not cause any sort of bells and whistles when you're trying to look around or actually inside of a network. And I'll give you an example. When we found out some of the ways of detecting these honeypots, we did a web scan of the entire internet-facing machines, and we found like thousands of them around the world, and we found that all organizations use these projects, even if it's from governments in the Middle East to high-tech corporations in the Valley. And they all use the same thing, and you can very easily understand what areas in the network are made to be able to trap attackers, what areas in the network are not, how to go about understanding that much more easily, and realizing what the defender is thinking you're going to do. So it's sort of like being able to get the schematics to a fort you're about to attack, and figuring out where all the traps are, and then giving the attacker the sensibility that you're about to attack him, but actually you're attacking him from a different place in the fort, just because you're raising a lot of alarms in one place, but the actual attack's coming from a different place. So it could be used in a way of misdirection, sort of like magicians. But it's just a technical ability that helps attackers in one more way against the defender's abilities and the solutions they use.
Interesting. Now, you're going to be presenting this also as a case study, right? You're concentrating on some platforms that are actually in real networks, and you're mapping them globally, right? Can you tell me a little bit more about exactly the the platforms that you're going to be showing off in
the session? Yeah, so we've looked at the most popular projects out there. Most of them are open source, but we also worked on one proprietary project. I can just throw out the list of names. It's Honeybee, Dionea, Kippo, Glassoff. The proprietary one is KS Sensor. Which one's a Birdtrap? I think I've covered it all. I might have forgotten one or two. But you'll be able to see all of them in the lecture or in the recordings.
So then what is it that we should be doing differently? If honeypots is such a great concept, a very powerful thing that we're generally doing such a poor job implementing, what should we be doing differently to implement them better?
So that's a very good question. Actually, while we were doing the research for the lecture, we realized with the way we're trying to detect a honeypot, our thinking process is the exact same way you should be building one. And that is the scheme of how a honeypot should be built in order to fool an attacker effectively, or, you know, hopefully fool an attacker effectively. And that's what we're going to be showing in the lecture. What's the actual scheme or paradigm you should be thinking about when you're building a honeypot? And that just means a lot of technicality, like how going about the service you're implementing and showing to the network. How is the machine that's giving off the service should look like, because an attacker will always look at the machine before he will try and interact with the service. And all sorts of questions along those lines. But if you can fill out all the questions, then you have a honeypot that has a chance of fooling an attacker.
Got it. Now, would you say then would you be better off not using a honeypot at all unless you're going to do it correctly? Because it sounds like if you're just going to do a lousy job, you're actually helping the bad guys more than you're helping yourself.
Well, I think
that's something that you could say about a lot of security, but in particular this one.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was just about to say. Using a security tool without realizing the proper way of using it or what it actually gives as value is not the right way about defending networks. And what our talk is about is showing how previously no one has talked about that with honeypots. And they're a very, very good tool, but for the specific purpose that they serve and not for what we feel a lot of the people in the industry and the community feel that it does.
Got it. Okay, well, you answered all of my questions. Is there something that I haven't asked you that you think that our listeners ought to know before I let you go?
No. I think we've covered most of it. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dean Zisman, CTO of Symmetria. Thanks a lot for being with us, Dean.
Thank you. And thank you for pronouncing my name correctly. It's a very, very nice touch. Yeah.
I do my best.
We appreciate both Sarah and Dean for their time and a little preview of what's going on in one of the sessions at Black Hat this week. Well, that's it for this episode of Black Hat Radio by Dark Reading. We'll be back here tomorrow at the same time. That's 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific, with another pair of interviews. We have another one that was conducted by Sarah Peters. Then we have Dark Reading Executive Editor Kelly Jackson Higgins, who sat down with another of our Black Hat speakers. And we're going to bring you both of those interviews tomorrow. Now, if you're listening to this on-demand format, we appreciate it. We hope that you'll plan to be here at Dark Reading tomorrow. There's a great conversation that can take place. We'd love to have your voice in that. As always, we appreciate you being here because, well, we could not and would not do it without you. For Marilyn Cahotas, Sarah Peters, and everyone at Dark Reading Radio. I'm Kurt Franklin. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you tomorrow.